From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
As we reported last week, China saw two of its top institutions convene over the past week. China's People's Political Consultative Conference, or the CPPCC, the country's primary political advisory board, and the National People's Congress, or NPC, the country's national legislature. The former is an instrument of civil society that serves in a consultative capacity to the latter, which is the government's main lawmaking body. Both had announced an intent to address some of the challenges facing China over the next year, including the economy. But as they met, a U.S. naval task force entered the South China Sea, and Washington announced impending joint military exercises with Japan and India. For more details, we have this report from CCTV.
Stirring up tensions. An American naval fleet, spearheaded by the aircraft carrier the USS John C. Stennis, has entered the South China Sea this week. Meanwhile, Washington's close ally, Japan, has confirmed it will be joining the US and India in a joint exercise this year in waters just northeast of the South China Sea, forming what some believe to be a maritime circle against China. These all come as the US accuses China of pursuing militarization in the South China Sea. China strongly denies the claim, saying it has taken the tough position of protecting its sovereignty in the South China Sea.
China's position on the South China Sea issue is clear and consistent. We firmly safeguard peace, stability and freedom of navigation and overflight in the area all countries are entitled to according to the international law. We hold that all disputes should be settled peacefully through negotiations.
Tensions are escalating and cooperation could become shaky as China and the US, the two major powers on opposite ends of the Pacific Ocean, apparently hold to their differences on the issue. Now more than ever, dialogue and understanding between the two sides is imperative.
Meanwhile, the U.S. and South Korea kicked off their largest ever annual joint military exercises Monday. China's foreign ministry expressed concern about the unprecedented scale of the joint drills. This was Foreign Ministry spokesperson Hong Lei.
The Korean Peninsula is linked with China by mountains and rivers, and China has major concerns over maintaining stability on the peninsula. China is resolutely against any provocations there, and it will by no means allow any chaos or wars happening outside its doorstep. We strongly hope that all the relevant sides can show restraint and refrain from mutual provocations exacerbating tensions.
China's concerns over the war games were shared by many inside South Korea itself, as Press TV's Frank Smith reported from Seoul.
As the U.S. and South Korea begin massive military exercises, activists call for peace talks and an end to the aggressive strategies employed by Seoul and Washington. In addition to opposing the drills, many believe North Korea is acting in self-defense in the face of U.S. provocation.
In reality, America's sanctions and pressure forced the North to develop nuclear weapons. The tension is escalating because of the sanctions and pressure. But nobody says that. Everyone only says North Korea did wrong. So that's why we, the younger generation, assert that the sanctions are useless.
Washington also seeks to move more weapons to South Korea. After months of speculation, the U.S. and South Korean militaries began talks last week on deploying the advanced U.S. missile system THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Aerial Defense. Experts say the system will only defend the U.S., not South Korea.
I don't think that is effective in protecting South Korea. The system targets missiles at altitudes of 40 to 150 kilometers. However, North Korean missiles fly at much lower altitudes, which will render THAAD ineffective. If the U.S. missile system is deployed in South Korea, it will be an unaffordable economic and security loss.
Joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises take place twice a year, generating tension on the Korean Peninsula. This year's drills follow United Nations Security Council sanctions against North Korea over Pyongyang's recent nuclear test and rocket launch.
The joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises will be the largest ever. With 300,000 South Korean soldiers and 15,000 U.S. troops scheduled to participate, double the number of last year. B-2 bombers, nuclear-powered submarines, and an aircraft carrier will also take part in the drills, scheduled to last through April 30th. Frank Smith, Press TV, Seoul.
But Washington dismissed China's concerns over the drills, also expressed by Russia last week. This was U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby, questioned about the drills by the AP's Matt Lee at the State Department's daily press briefing Monday.
Anybody to be angry or disconcerted about this exercise? They have been going on, as I said, for roughly 40 years. And they are designed to do what all military exercises are designed to do, which is sharpen and improve coordination and capabilities. And that's what they're going to do. So there's no reason for anybody to be disconcerted, alarmed, or upset about an exercise we've been conducting for, again, 40 years. And the Chinese military exercises their forces. The Russian military, last time I looked, conduct military exercises and training operations. That's what militaries do.
On the periphery of the CPPCC, China's ambassador to the U.S., Shui Tian-Kai, spoke with CCTV's Tian Wei about the state of U.S.-China relations.
It seems, apparently, at least for now, U.S. and China have very different vision about the rules and how things should proceed in the future in the region.
South China Sea is not and should not become an issue between China and the United States, because geographically, the United States is far away from South China Sea. And the official position of the U.S. government is that the U.S. has no territorial claims in South China Sea and takes no position on the territorial disputes. This is the official position of the United States government. But the problem is that if you watch closely some of the U.S. officials or senior military personnel, if you watch very closely what they are saying or what they are doing, you have the impression that the United States is taking sides and maybe taking the wrong side. I think this is a problem. And also on the issue of South China Sea, I think the United States, or maybe some people in the United States, are advocating some of the ideas that are totally not based on facts. For instance, many people in the U.S. are saying that the United States will have to defend the freedom of navigation. But the problem is that the freedom of navigation they are talking about is different from freedom of navigation that is provided for in the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. So that's a very different concept. Because when the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea was adopted, the United States could not accept the idea of freedom of navigation. Some people in the U.S. believe that they should have unconditioned, unrestricted freedom anywhere in the world. So that's why they launched what they call Freedom of Navigation Operation. So this operation was actually a challenge to the freedom of navigation as provided for by the convention.
It is not only, Mr. Ambassador, the terminologies that actually should provoke some thoughts, but also what is really behind the very different interpretations of these terminologies. Do you think the two countries likely to be very strategically in conflict on the issue of South China Sea?
Honestly, I'm quite worried about the situation, about possible escalation of the situation in South China Sea. And I'm quite worried by acts by the U.S. military to use their term, to militarize the region or the situation there. You see, the U.S. has sent a lot of military vessels and a lot of military planes to South China Sea, including strategic bombers. This is a clear evidence that some people in the United States are attempting to militarize the situation there. And that will hurt everybody's interests. So we are quite worried and we are opposed to that.
What do you think of all of the actions, if or probably reactions coming from China in building up on the South China Sea? And what do you make of others' concern about that?
I think all these accusations against China are not based on facts. Because we have sovereignty over the islands and reefs in South China Sea. But the problem is that some of the other countries, some of our neighbors, over the years have illegally occupied so many of them. I think altogether 42 islands and reefs have been illegally occupied by some other states. And for one of them occupied 29. And they have built military facilities on these islands and reefs, including airstrip, including heavy artillery, and even missiles. So we have to do something to defend our own interests.
But they're saying, well, China, you are such a strong party. I mean, for the other country, they're in the South China Sea, much smaller country, much economically weaker ones. Can't China just be a big nation and show your attitude as brothers in the region? Why do you have to take away everything that the others want? You're already so strong.
It's really absurd to listen to such argument made by Americans. Look at what the United States have done in the world. Is this showing us a good example of how a big power should behave in connection with smaller powers? And besides, what China is doing is just to defend our legitimate interests. We are not invading other countries. We are not taking over islands that belong to other countries. We are not doing that. We always stand for, even for the islands that we strongly believe it's ours, we have sovereignty over them. But if others have disputes, we still stand for bilateral negotiation with them. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have resolved the border issue with most of our neighbors on the land through bilateral negotiation. And we are ready to do the same on the sea. But we cannot just sit here and do nothing if others continue to occupy our islands and reefs. We have to do something to defend ourselves. If others are not provoking, they have nothing to worry about.
But at the same time, what do you make of some of the candidates' remarks toward China, mainly bashing at this moment? Is China still going to be the victim of the U.S. presidential race?
Well, you see, the presidential election and the campaign is basically domestic politics of the United States. So we don't want to have anything to do with it. And I just hope that this play of domestic politics will not affect China-U.S. relations in a very negative way. Of course, maybe some of them have the habit of bashing other countries, not only China. They're also bashing, for instance, Mexico, Muslim countries, and a lot of others. But basically, I think what the American people are interested in is their own life, their own economy, opportunities for themselves. So that's why we believe this is basically a domestic issue for the United States.
Should China play a role in communicating with some of the important candidates, helping them to understand what China has in mind, and helping them to formulate what they might have in mind for China and U.S. relations in the future?
Yeah, I think we should do that, because there's so much at stake for this relationship. Mm-hmm. We have to work together to manage this relationship in a very positive and productive way. A number of very senior American friends told me, senior in terms of their political position or of their seniority, and some of them used to be very high-ranking officials in the government, and others are still working for important think tanks. So they are the so-called opinion leaders in the United States. And they told me that the world, globally, the world is faced with increasing disorder. And they are worried about that. And they believe China and the United States should work together to respond to such growing disorder. And this is our responsibility. I do share their views. I think that's why we have to take a global perspective We have to put our relationship in the global perspective and realize that our two great countries have to work together to make the world more stable, more prosperous. This will not only serve the national interests of China and the United States, but also this is our shared responsibility to the global community.
What is it like for you as a communicator, as a go-betweener between these two countries, to make your points heard, not only through the years, but also going to the heart and mind?
Yeah, this is a very big challenge, of course, especially when the two great countries have so much interaction with each other, and the two countries have so different historical heritage, so different culture, very different political system, and at very different levels of economic development. So it's not easy to have mutual understanding. But mutual understanding and mutual confidence is the foundation for good, constructive, and a positive relationship. So as a diplomat, we have to do our best for that. But we cannot achieve this goal all by ourselves. We need the support of the general public of both countries, and maybe especially the media.
Tian Wei also hosted a discussion about China's economic growth, particularly in the New Silk Road region. She spoke with Mohammed Mirandi from the University of Tehran, Heiwen Ping from China's Academy of Social Sciences, and Nicola Casarini from the Italian Institute of International Affairs.
May I have your views first, Professor Mirandi? Iran can be a very different country. We have learned the recent result of the parliamentary election. We have also learned the gradual lifting of sanctions toward Iran. How much momentum do you think all of these internal and outside changes could eventually bring Iran a new position in terms of its relations with China?
Yes, I think the very fact that Iran can repeatedly hold elections in the country for parliament, the presidency, local elections, and otherwise, shows that Iran is a very stable country, a very dynamic country, and this can happen in a country, the fact that this can happen in a country that is surrounded largely by chaos, civil wars, and family dictatorships, I think reveals that Iran is a partner that can be relied on. It is the rock of stability in this region. And in addition, I think that the nuclear agreement between Iran and the P5+1 gives a greater opportunity for countries like China, as well as others, to do trade with Iran. And thirdly, I would also point out that in the region, Iran is now being seen by the populations. For example, here in Beirut, I'm at a conference where one of the central themes is Wahhabism and the threat of Wahhabism. People are seeing Iran across the globe as being the main protector of the minorities and the people in this region against extremism. So I think putting these together shows that Iran is a very good partner for anyone who wishes to do trade.
What about the lifting of sanctions? How fast do you think, Professor Mirandi, that Iran could gather itself together, even though it has already got some very strong economic link with China earlier, but creating new opportunities and new possibilities for not only China, but also others as well? You have got your own multilateralism, just as China is also developing its own strategy on that point as well. Professor.
Well, I think that the lifting of the sanctions is creating greater opportunities, especially for European countries. But I think that China, as well as Russia, because of their close relationship with the country over the past few years, is still a priority. And in Iran, the development of the Silk Road, or the One Belt, One Road policy, is very key, because Iran does most of its trade to the west, to the south, and it would like to develop its trade with the North and the East. And the One Silk, One Road, of course, would not only link Iran and China, but it would also be an incentive for countries in Central Asia to develop their economies. So it would be an extraordinarily powerful boost. The only threat, of course, is instability in Central Asia, and therefore countries in the region must take care that extremists do not find a foothold in any of these countries. Mm.
Professor Mirandi, you are a political scientist. You know this better than I do, that Iran really has to keep a very delicate balance. On the one hand, it's an influential country in the region, therefore shouldering certain responsibilities. But Iran, by history, particularly being portrayed by the media, must be believed by some as having different agendas and egos. So how is Iran likely to keep a delicate balance in that regard for others to feel, China, including China, to feel that Iran is a safe political partner and is a safe trade partner in the future as well?
Well, I think with regards to politics, the very fact that Iran has very close relations with its neighbors, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, is evidence in itself. Both Iraq and Afghanistan are very vulnerable to extremism. The sort of both Al-Qaeda and ISIL exist in both countries. Yet the central government of Iraq, as well as the central government of Afghanistan, rely heavily on Iran to prevent these sort of extremist groups from gaining the upper hand. Of course, there are other countries that help them as well, but I think the very fact that Iran's immediate neighbors are so closely associated with the country is evidence in itself. While Iran has been invaded with U.S. and European support under Saddam Hussein, Iran has never had any intention to retaliate. In fact, the new Iraqi government, the post-Saddam Hussein government, is now considered to be Iran's most important trading partner in the region. So the fact that Iran can develop ties so quickly and so extensively and create an alliance with a country which was at war with it just a couple of days ago, I think itself is evidence enough.
We see a very confident Professor Mirandi with his country's future, of course. But it is not just Iran, which is an interesting case study to have along China's Belt and Road initiatives. There are also other countries who traditionally with China, even in history, many fascinating stories. That, of course, what I'm talking about is Italy. Focus on Italy for now, which sits at the end point of the Maritime Silk Road. The friendship between China and Italy dates back hundreds of years when Marco Polo embarked on a trip to Asia, during which he spent 17 years in China. His reports helped familiarize Italian people and also the Europeans with Chinese civilization. And then during the Ming Dynasty, Italian missionary Matteo Ricci also came to China and was one of the first promoters of Catholicism in China. He formed a cultural bridge between the two countries. These are all very, very important history for the two countries. Of course, now we have outbound investment coming from China to Italy. Therefore, let me go to you, Mr. Catarini. History is there, but the thing is, how can we make a new version of history? How much can the Road and Belt initiatives likely to help with that from Italian perspective?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me at this in this program. And that's an important question. The Belt and Road is possibly China's biggest diplomatic and geopolitical initiative in decades. And Italy, as you mentioned, stands in a very particular position at the center of the Mediterranean. Now, how can we make a win-win situation whereby Chinese investments are coming towards the Mediterranean and Europe, and so the thing could be beneficial for both? But essentially, it's about to create those conditions whereby the investments from China create jobs and opportunities in Europe. And this is what it is happening right now, especially in Italy. There has been a great inflow of Chinese investments in the last years. Mm. But it is also the other way around. The Belt and Road is not only about investments and infrastructure, it's also about people, connectivity between people. You mentioned Marco Polo and Matteo Ricci. Nowadays, more and more young people, students from Italy, other parts of Europe, go more and more to China. Well, Chinese students and other people come to Europe. I think this is also another important aspect of the Belt and Road. Connectivity between people.
Right, connectivity, yes, indeed. But it is no secret that European countries, Italy, for example, has been experiencing some dramatic economic challenges over the years. The question is also not only about opportunities going into Italy, but rather how Italy is likely, with the help of Belt and Road initiatives, catching the opportunity and reinvent yourself. On that point, I know Europeans love to debate, Dr. Casarini. I wonder whether there are similar debates going on in your countries as well.
Yes, yes, you touched a very important point, the reinvention of like a situation given the possibilities provided by the Belt and Road. I'll give you two examples. One's infrastructure, but the other one is logistics. Italy is full of ports. Now, for the time being, there has been like the direction investments has been to Greece, like in the port of Piraeus, and to some extent to Spanish ports. Now, Italy stands to benefit in providing the political and economic conditions to accept the Chinese investments in Italian ports. Mm-hmm. That's an important element for Italy to reinvent itself, to become again what has traditionally been in centuries the heart of the Mediterranean. And another element is, of course, as I mentioned before, connectivity between people, tourism, the tourist industry. Now, more and more Chinese people go abroad, and as we know, Italy is possibly one of the most visited countries and the country that houses the largest amount of like treasures when it comes to archaeology, museums, etc. So again, here we have the possibility. Now, the problem is the political level. Because like there are like some parts of the population right. that have negative attitudes towards China. So the importance at this point of having the political elite to be able to indicate that there are huge benefits
right.
and those concerns which are inevitable that have need to be managed.
Mm.
But I think like nowadays right. opportunities still surpass the drawbacks.
Ms. He, you've been attentively listened to your two other colleagues earlier. That's from their perspective.
Yes.
But what about from China when China is developing this multilateralism?
You know, in Chinese words, there is a very interesting word called weiji. Pronounced in the Mandarin, which means the opportunity always hands in hands with these challenges. So you are quite right. You're all the way around this one belt, one road. You can see the political situation, some area is not so stable. As our Iranian friend said, Iran has been surrounded by those countries now with some chaos. So, but that couldn't prevent it. Those Belt Road initiative marching forward. I recall earlier this year, President Xi Jinping visited Saudi and also Iran. Mm. At that time, these two countries happened to be at a very complicated relationship. They even cut diplomatic ties. So some opinion saying, well, maybe that's not the good time for. Give this visit, but President Xi still goes there. So which means. Because they have some chaos, and then China can play its role. Not only this connectivity about economic ties, we also can do some connectivity things for funding those, the relations with them. So we can build, serving as a bridge role for passing some message between them and also trying to persuade them to sit around the negotiating table.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.